Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the December 30th edition of The New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is The Professional Health Insurance CEO Nagger by Carrie Batten. In these United States, the professional health insurance CEO Nagger, Susan Frager, known as the psych billing coach, helps therapists appeal coverage denials. Her job got more difficult after the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson by Carrie Batten, December 23, 2024. When Susan Frager tells people about her work, she is accustomed to receiving confused stares. Once, a taxi driver in Ireland asked her about her job. "I don't know if I can explain it to you because it doesn't exist in Ireland," she told him. Her spectacularly American job is to provide coaching to therapists and psychiatrists struggling to navigate the labyrinthine process of billing health insurance companies. She calls herself the psych billing coach. The cabbie didn't get it. On December 4th, the day that UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson was murdered, Frager's job, typically perceived as a confounding paperwork puzzle, was suddenly linked to a nationwide obsession that had a vice grip on social media and news outlets. Much of her work involves writing letters and emails to CEOs of major health insurance providers to appeal claims that have been denied. "I did not know Brian Thompson personally, but I wrote him letters all the time," she said over Zoom the other day. "I'm surprised about the shooting, but I'm not surprised at the reaction. Therapists are kind of like, yeah, we told you so." She went on, "I'm just fascinated by this sick system. I have found that if you go to the exec level, they'll just give you what you want, but it takes a lot of guts. It was 8 a.m. in Washington State, where Frager lives, and a string of Christmas lights was twinkling in her living room." Frager, who is 58 years old, started her career with the intention of becoming a therapist. After getting licensed, she was hired by a company that required her to schedule 36 patients a week. Many therapists consider 20 to 25 a full slate. She was burned out after a year and transferred into a more administrative role, reviewing other therapists' treatment reports. She learned the ropes of health insurance billing, and eventually she became a full-time independent biller, someone in charge of processing claims for care providers. As a biller, Frager noticed the insurance company's increasingly sophisticated claim denial tactics, even after a 2008 federal law was passed requiring them to treat mental health care as essential in their coverage protocols. Over time, customer service representatives were replaced with online portals and overseas call centers, resulting in a crushing sense of defeat among the clinicians and patients seeking reimbursement. "Around 10% of the claims that are denied are ever appealed," Frager said. "They're making bank on the fact that people don't appeal." Filing appeals became more difficult after insurers started offloading claim reviews to AI. "That's when going to the CEO is literally your only option," Frager said. "I try to be a thorn in their side." In 2021, overwhelmed with clients and the red tape around the billing process, Frager revamped her business model and began coaching therapists, charging $150 an hour to help clients draft letters to CEOs that hint at legal repercussions. "If she suspects that a company is skirting the law, I kind of lay out the facts and I say, hey, you might want to consult corporate counsel. This may be a violation of blah, blah, blah. The penalties for this could be," and I list them. Though Frager chose not to pursue a new therapy license after moving to Washington, many of her consultations take on a therapeutic air. "I've known for quite some time that there's been a lid on this hell that's boiling and boiling," she said. "I've been dealing with so much anger on the part of patients and clinicians to the point where I've started to have some secondary trauma." She has built up a large enough client roster to transition to her new subscription service called the Rescue Biller, with which providers can easily access the information needed to solve dozens of types of problems. One might assume that, with the new scrutiny on the health insurance industry, Chasing down reimbursements might become smoother. But after Thompson's killing, many insurance companies removed executive names and bios from their websites. Now social media is cheering Luigi Mangione on, but it's going to make my job a lot harder, Frigger said. I need the names. Carrie Batten began contributing to The New Yorker in 2015 and became a staff writer in 2018. Up in the sky, searching for real New Jersey drones at a fake alien landing site. An amateur UFO hunter at Grover's Mill of the War of the World fame makes a shocking discovery. By Robert Sullivan. What more can you say about the drones that are attacking, or correction, appear to be attacking New Jersey? You've heard all the theories. Iranian spy drones launched from a ship, drones launched by China, drones launched from locations known only to the president and the Pentagon, via the president-elect Donald Trump, who said, something strange is going on. The friendlier theories have it that the drones are searching for something, e.g. a radioactive medical device that the state's Department of Environmental Protection had, in fact, reported missing on December 5th. I think it's probably us, listening and watching, Michael Mellum, the mayor of Belleville, said. The lost device, used for CAT scans, was found by FedEx. But if you head out into central Jersey on a cold, clear night to look for stuff, Mellum's words resonate. I never saw anything like it, the mayor said. Dozens and dozens of drones coming in from all different areas. We were swarmed last night. The sky started looking unusual in November, first in central Jersey along the Raritan River, then north into the Highlands. Then drones were spotted in Monmouth County, where the sheriff told Fox News that he wants the legal authority to de-drone. Drones were in the Pine Barrens, inching into Staten Island, and also in the Bronx. Local news posted videos that are either hard to discern or feature planes or helicopters landing somewhere in a state with close to 500 places to land planes or helicopters. One North Jersey reporter likened his daily commute to the helicopter scene in Goodfellas. As thousands began to report seeing drones, some the size of cars, officials were stumped. Sometimes the reports were actually drones, but mostly not, and when some police drones filmed real drones, the real drones seemed to vanish. A big issue, drones are everywhere. There are a million registered in the U.S., deployed by the police, and now delivering Jersey Mike subs in Holly Springs, North Carolina. In the gap between what authorities can verify and what they can't, more drone questions take flight, especially on WKXW, aka New Jersey 101.5. We're talking drones, Bill Spadia, the host of the Morning Drive show, said recently. Why? Because that's what everybody's talking about. In between ads for toenail fungus treatment, people call in with sightings and Spadia asks drone questions. Do you buy into the fact that they lost a nuclear package? He asked Brian Fitzherbert, a Republican defense contractor from South Jersey. That one's a tough one, Fitzherbert said. Spadia, who is running for governor as a pro-Trump Republican, is the former host of Chasing News, a defunct local Fox program. He frames drone sightings in anti-government ire. As governor, I would order a state of emergency, put the National Air Guard on alert, and mobilize our state police to start chasing these drones down, he said. At that point, we'll find out whose side our federal government is really on. Skywatchers note, New Jersey has a history of hoaxes. The Great Morriston UFO hoax, in which two men attached red flares to helium balloons in 2009, had people seeing things for weeks, despite the police saying that they were reasonably certain that they were red flares attached to a balloon. The most famous hoax centered on Grover's Mill, the hamlet that a scriptwriter randomly chose as the Martian landing site in Orson Welles' 1938 radio adaptation of The War of the Worlds. If you showed up at the fake landing site last week, you could feel a little something in the air, perhaps because the Defense Department had not yet set up the finely tuned drone detection devices being shipped into the state, a system invented to prevent bird strikes at airports. On the town pond, house lights reflected in the water. The geese flew overhead, honking loudly, though invisible. If you had a telescope, you would have spotted a quick orange glow, low at the dark edge of the woods, but then would have realized that it was only a cigarette held by a distant smoker. But somehow, before packing up, you could look in the telescope and see a giant incandescent sphere with three white orbs circling it, Jupiter, brighter even than the stars. Robert Sullivan is the author of books including Double Exposure. Profiles, the Hollywood slog that led Adam Scott to Severance. TV's preeminent office guy has never worked a regular 9-to-5, but his years as a struggling actor taught him what it's like to toil anonymously. By Rachel Syme. In late 2012, Dan Erickson was a 28-year-old aspiring screenwriter in L.A., working a dull job in office management at a door parts company. Day after day, he sat at a computer monitor cataloging hinges and cabinet pulls. He longed to escape the drudgery, but he needed the money. He was saddled with debt and drove a dinky scooter to save on gas. One morning while walking to work, Erickson had a thought. What if I could skip ahead to the end of the day and my work would magically be done? During his lunch breaks, he began turning this idea into a pilot for a high-concept workplace thriller called Severance. The result was part The Office, part Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. A sinister corporation called Lumen Industries has invented a microchip brain implant that can bisect a person's consciousness into an innie and an outie, an office self and a home self. Lumen employees who choose to have the implant installed work on a subterranean severed floor of Lumen's headquarters. The chip is activated as they ride an elevator down, erasing their knowledge of their outside lives. Their home selves, in turn, know nothing of what happens within the office's walls. The show's protagonist, Mark Scout, is a severed man toiling in Lumen's macrodata refinement department, sorting numbers into arbitrary groupings. Outside the office, his outie is a bereft widower who chose to sever his mind just to get some emotional relief. At work, his innie is upbeat, affable, on task, and like his severed co-workers, effectively trapped forever at the office by design. From the time Erickson began writing the script, he had the actor Adam Scott in mind for the role. Erickson had admired Scott's performance in the hit NBC sitcom Parks and Recreation as Ben Wyatt, a geeky budget advisor who ultimately wins the heart of the show's protagonist, the bubbly bureaucrat Leslie Knope, Amy Poehler. Parks, along with the cult comedy series Party Down, about a group of failed actors turned cater waiters, helped establish Scott as an endearing version of TV's working everyman, whose sardonic veneer belies an inner core of hopeful sweetness. This métier has been defined in part by Scott's physical appearance, which straddles the line between hunky and nondescript. Medium height, slightly hangdog eyes, thick chestnut hair that juts like a cockatiel's crest. As Michael Schur, the co-creator of Parks, put it to me, he's memorable in unmemorable parts. Severance, an office dystopia, needed a guy regular enough to ground viewers in the rules of its heightened sci-fi world, but intriguing enough to make you suspect that he's more than a drone. In 2015, the head of television at Red Hour, a production company run by the actor and director Ben Stiller, received Erickson's pilot, which also made The Blood List, an online compendium of promising unproduced horror scripts. Stiller, who had previously directed both madcap film comedies, Zoolander, Tropic Thunder, and a dark television drama, Escape It, Denimora, immediately took to the concept, and he and Erickson began revising the script in 2016. With no awareness of Erickson's casting idea, Stiller told me recently, he too concluded that Mark should be played by Adam Scott. Stiller and Scott had worked together briefly in 2013 when Scott had a small role as an office billy in Stiller's The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and they kept in touch. Stiller, who spent his own early career feeling pigeonholed as a tightly wound straight man in comedies like Meet the Parents and There's Something About Mary, knew that Scott yearned to play more dramatically challenging characters. There are actors like Bryan Cranston who get to go to another place when people see them in a certain role, Stiller told me, referring to Cranston's reputational leap from playing a sitcom dad on Malcolm in the Middle to a ruthless drug lord on Breaking Bad. That's what I felt with this. In January of 2017, Stiller called Scott and pitched him on the show. Scott read the script and loved it. It felt too good to be true, he told me recently. I pretty much assumed it would disappear. It nearly did. Stiller sold the show to Apple, which was preparing to launch a new streaming service, Apple TV Plus, and the same qualities that had made Erickson and Stiller want Scott, the sense that he could be anyone, that he could almost be overlooked, made him a harder sell to Apple. Executives were hesitant to cast him. Stiller refused to commit to an alternative, and a year of developmental stalemate ensued. Finally, Stiller sent Scott a late-night email. Apple was open to considering him, but only if Scott agreed to tape an audition for the part he thought he already had. Stiller feared that Scott would consider this demeaning and walk, but Scott, who is now 51, spent the first 15 years of his career as a struggling actor, and even after the success of Parks and a part on the popular HBO drama Big Little Lies 2017, he'd maintain a swallow-your-pride mindset. When Scott read Stiller's email, he was in a rental trailer in Atlanta, completing a shoot as the host of a short-lived ABC game show called Don't. Scott said, "I remember sitting there thinking, am I in any position to say no thanks to audition for probably the best pilot I've ever read?" He wrote back to Stiller in like 5 seconds, and after reading for the part, he secured the job. Severance premiered in February of 2022 to wide acclaim. Amid a glut of bloated, forgettable streaming shows, the series stood out for its amusingly stilted tone and retro-futuristic mise-en-scene and for the psychological dimensions of its cryptic puzzle box structure. In this magazine, Naomi Fry called it sci-fi for the soul. At a time when the pandemic was prompting people to interrogate their relationships to their workplaces, the show had a fortuitous claim to the zeitgeist. In The Times, James Poniewozik wrote that it might be the first great TV show of the Great Resignation. Lumen's sleek office looked like a cross between a mid-century library and an Apple store. And there was a piquant irony in a tech giant producing a show that lampoons corporate surveillance. The ensemble cast included veteran stars, among them John Turturro, Christopher Walken, and Patricia Arquette, as the viperous severed floor boss. But Scott's subtly humane performance as Mark was what Stiller calls the beating heart of the story. In 2022, Scott received his first Emmy nomination for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series. Scott is temperamentally resistant to admitting he's had success. When I first met him for lunch at a hipster pizza place in LA Studio City in November, 2 months before the premiere of Severance Season 2, he told me that he still worries that he's not very good as an actor. And that's not in a showy way, like how imposter syndrome has become this buzzword now, and most people are using it to humble brag, he added. In person, as in some of his best-known roles, he speaks with a deadpan delivery that can seem self-protective, a word against humiliation. When I asked him the secret to achieving his impressive hair volume, he answered flatly, "Propecia." His style is haute dadcore, slim-cut khakis, wax field jackets, pristine sneakers. Last summer, after he turned 50, he bought an electric Porsche Taycan, then fretted that it made him look like a middle-aged cliché. Whether he wanted to show off the car or just his nice guy bona fides, he offered to drive me to my friend's house after lunch. He described the lead-up to Severance Season 1, when billboards featured his face popped up all over Los Angeles, as one of the most stressful periods of his life. Every time he comes out with a new project, he told me, My default position is to think it will either make zero noise or be embarrassing. Weeks later, worried that complaining about being on Billboard sounded so gross, he added, "The thing is, I live daily with the fear of anyone thinking I think I'm great." Ben from Parks and Recreation is an incorrigible pop culture nerd whose passions include 90s indie rock and Batman movies, complicated board games, and fantasy series. In one scene that has become an internet meme, an unemployed Ben spends 3 weeks making a 3-second claymation music video. When his close friend Rob, played by Rob Lowe, suggests that he might be depressed, Ben brandishes a clumsy clay figurine of his likeness and asks, "Do you think a depressed person could make this?" Ben's interests are fixational tendencies were based partly on Scott's. For the past decade, Scott has had a side gig as the co-host with the comedian Scott Aukerman of a popular music podcast on which they, Scott and Scott, analyze the discographies of their favorite bands one album at a time. The seasons have aggressively goofy names. You Talkin' U2 to Me, You Springin' Springsteen on My Bean, and the forthcoming You Talkin' Billy Joel to My E-Hole. But as Jesse David Fox, who covers comedy for Vulture, put it to me, the humor of the show stems from Scott's ability to idle in neutral. Fox added, "He's a dude who loves this normie music, and he is unafraid to sound really, really boring or basic about it." On the season Are You Talking R.E.M. Re-Me, Scott divulged that in his R.E.M.-obsessed youth, he'd been an extra in the music video for the band song Drive. In the time since, he's scrolled through the video repeatedly, frame by frame, but could never find himself. A podcast listener trawled the footage and finally spotted him, beaming upward as Michael Stipe crowd surfs overhead. Scott grew up in Santa Cruz as the third and youngest child of divorced parents. He was what he described as a chubby kid who was bullied for his weight at school. He lived mostly with his mom, Anne, an artist and a special education teacher, who didn't own a television. But when Scott was 9 years old, his dad, Dougald, a biology professor at a community college, gave him a portable black and white TV set. Scott would watch shows at night in his bedroom, The Twilight Zone, Late Night with David Letterman. "I found something so comforting in that dry, sardonic Midwestern stance," he recalled. After school, he'd loiter at a local video store, reading the backs of the VHS boxes, and he cultivated a budding identity as a film connoisseur. In high school, he hung a photograph of Martin Scorsese in his locker. After seeing Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, he grew a goatee and wore a Knicks hat for an entire year. Scott lost his baby weight and made the water polo team, which in Santa Cruz, he told me, was more socially advantageous than playing football. During his sophomore year, a drama teacher caught him peeking into the school theater and encouraged him to try out for a play. He was loath to jeopardize his new shot at popularity, but he agreed and soon became single-minded about acting. He appeared in school productions of Blue Denim and Guys and Dolls and let his studies slip to the point where he was put on academic probation. As a senior with the kind of outsized confidence endemic among high school thespians, he declared that he was moving to Hollywood to make it as an actor. Scott enrolled in the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in Pasadena, an acting school he chose in part because eligible applicants needed only a 2.0 GPA. He dreamed of becoming what he called a serious actor, like Robert De Niro or Al Pacino. During his second year, Scott briefly tried using the surname Cordero, a shortened version of his mother's Sicilian maiden name, thinking that it might lend him some similarly actorly gravitas. "Adam Scott," he told me, "sounds generic and fake." He scribbled his new autograph several times on a piece of paper, but felt totally embarrassed and abandoned the moniker. Later, after he made the mistake of telling this story to his castmates on Party Down, they began shouting Cordero anytime he'd film a scene that was even slightly sincere. For a Gen Xer raised on movies that skewered phonies and wannabes, the thought of being a poser was, in the end, far more offensive to his sensibilities than being potentially bland. They say a name can be a kind of a destiny, and there was no use outrunning his. I was clearly meant to play the befuddled beta male, he said. While at the Academy, Scott met Paul Rudd, a recent graduate who had landed a Nintendo commercial right out of school, making him the program's resident golden boy. Scott, with a lingering trace of high school jock, calls his male actor friends by their last names. Ham, Bateman, Lowe, everybody knew Rudd, he said. The two men connected over their similar ambitions. Rudd told me we probably shared a bit of disdain for the fact that we were struggling actors and the cliches that come along with that. Rudd did not have to struggle for long. In 1995, he scored his breakout role as the brainy love interest in the blockbuster teen comedy Clueless. Scott's path, as Rudd delicately put it, was a bit of a slower burn. Besides a brief stint as a busboy at Johnny Rockets, Scott told me, he has never worked a day job or a regular 9-to-5, but his early years in Hollywood gave him vivid experience of a certain kind of demoralizing grind. After finishing drama school, he signed with a small-time manager, and his life became a conveyor belt of auditions, rejections, and parts that ranged in size from bit to slightly less bit. He appeared on an MTV series called Dead at 21 as a chest wound victim on an episode of ER. He appeared in the background of a Tia Carrere music video and made his film debut as an 18th century dandy in the horror sequel Hellraiser Bloodline. He appeared in single episodes of the cop shows NYPD Blue and High Incident. He had a brief romantic arc as Nev Campbell's crush on Party of Five, and a 4-episode stint on Boy Meets World. Maybe some of my peers thought Boy Meets World was lame, or they were like, we don't do TV, Scott told me, adding, I do fucking whatever. One especially humbling experience was an audition for the Western Wild Bill, starring Jeff Bridges. In the waiting room, Scott found dozens of other aspirants who looked like him, except they dressed for the part in cowboy hats and riding gear, whereas he'd worn a flannel shirt and cut-off cargo pants. Flustered, he flubbed his read so badly that the director invited him to go again. When Scott left the room after his second try, he passed a young Matt Damon, waiting his turn. I was like, yeah, Damon's here. I'm not getting this one, he said. He owned a pager just so his manager could alert him about auditions, and spent much of his time between jobs sitting around in the dark, smoking cigarettes and waiting for that beeper to go off. He added, I didn't go on trips. I didn't have any hobbies. I just stuck around and waited to be called to some rinky-dink office building to read a script. He'd often go on 5 auditions a day, paying for gas with quarters he dug out from an ashtray of his beat-up Oldsmobile. His father remembers visiting Scott around this time and driving around with him between casting calls. He had to keep getting out to change his clothes on the side of the road, Doug Old said. Scott lived for a while in a crappy, creepy apartment in Hollywood, right across the street from the Scientology Celebrity Center. The church was notorious for luring in young industry strivers. One of Scott's good friends had joined. I never went in for a stress test, Scott joked, referring to the church's infamous intake assessment. I was already pretty aware of my stress level at the time. At one point, he did visit a psychic, asking her why he had yet to land a plum role. In 1998, Scott met his wife, Naomi, a producer, at a bar on Sunset Boulevard. Early in their relationship, she asked Scott if he had ever considered doing something besides acting. My mom always said you should learn accounting, just in case, she told me. So I asked him, pretty flippantly, I now realized, what he would do if acting didn't work out. And I remember him blanching. He never thought about it. Scott told me he considered giving up only once when he narrowly missed getting a part in the HBO drama 6 Feet Under that ultimately went to Michael C. Hall. He'd made it down to the final 3. Losing the job, he recalled, was a body blow. A few years later, he got a call that he was up for a small role in The Aviator, a film by Scorsese Scott's idol from adolescence, as a wisecracking press agent for Leonardo DiCaprio's Howard Hughes. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. To prepare, Scott grew a pencil mustache, rented a zoot suit, and studied classic screwball comedies. The morning of his audition, Naomi left a post-it note on Scott's mirror that read, "Good luck, you deserve this." Scott got the part, but the film did not turn out to be the big, career-launching break that he'd hoped for. Recounting Naomi's faith in him during his protracted fallow period, Scott broke down in tears. Then he groaned and shook his head rapidly like a dog sloughing off bathwater. "I cannot fucking believe I cried," he said. "Jesus Christ." One morning in November, Scott was at the headquarters of Great Scott, a production company that he and Naomi co-run. It occupies a wooden bungalow on the lot of Radford Studio Center, where Parks and Recreation was filmed. Scott and Naomi live close by with their two teenage children. They launched their company, originally called Getting Rad, in 2012 with the series of classic television spoofs for the Cartoon Network's Adult Swim block, and specialized in what Scott called quick and dirty film and TV projects. They are currently producing an independent feature called The Saviors, which stars Scott as a coddled dum-dum who rents his guest house out to a couple he begins to suspect might be terrorists. Scott met me at the door wearing a spotless white baseball cap and Sperry topsiders, like David Byrne wears in Stop Making Sense, he told me. "And if you think that's an accident, you're insane." Inside, in an office he shares with Naomi, two identical white desks face each other. The room was decorated with framed photographs of Scott on the set of Severance, posing with his Parks and Recreation castmates in tuxedos meeting Barack Obama, plus a large portrait of Barbara Streisand. "That's all, Naomi," he said. A bookcase held a porcelain reproduction of his favorite snack, the kindergarten staple Ants on a Log. Scott told me that an assistant who'd gifted him the sculpture used to prepare it for him, but he was mortified when he caught her on the Severance set wearing surgical gloves and in a task worthy of a Lumen employee, piping peanut butter onto celery sticks. He pointed out one of his most prized possessions, a lightsaber that was given to him by Mark Hamill as a surprise stunt on an episode of Jimmy Kimmel Live. In a clip of the segment that went viral, Scott, visibly shaken, tells Hamill, "This really is one of the best moments of my life." Scott's fanboy identity can fit awkwardly with his rising stature in Hollywood. The night before he was supposed to shoot his first scene on Severance with Christopher Walken and John Turturro, he got so excited to see his name next to theirs on the call sheet that he stayed up until 4 a.m. The next morning, he overslept and arrived on set hours late. When he had the chance to meet Al Pacino at a Vanity Fair Oscars party in 2022, he hid behind a potted palm tree. Pacino spotted him and approached to say he was a Severance fan. Looking back, Scott said he wonders if his reverence for dramatic actors made him miss the early signs of his affinity for comedy. He'd always loved the Albert Brooks film Defending Your Life, a warmly funny fantasy about an executive in the afterlife. What if Brooks, rather than Pacino, had been his lodestar? Scott's acting career finally started to click when, with the help of Rudd's connections, he began migrating towards comedic roles. Judd Apatow gave Scott a small part as a male nurse in Knocked Up, 2007, which inspired the director Adam McKay, a friend of Apatow's, to cast Scott in Step Brothers, 2008, as an entitled antagonist of the titular siblings, played by Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. At the age of 34, Scott unearthed a new talent for portraying another familiar breed of dude, the smug asshole, a role he later reprised in both The Good Place and Walter Mitty. In 2008, he got cast on Party Down, when Rudd, who co-created the show, was too busy to star in it himself. Party Down had a colorful ensemble cast, including Megan Mullaney and Jane Lynch, and was drolly astute about the service industry's way of bringing the rich and famous into cringy contact with those who only aspire to be. But it got barely any attention during its initial 2-season run on Starz. The season finale, which aired in the summer of 2010, received a 0.0 Nielsen rating. Over the following decade, however, the show acquired a cult following through DVDs and streaming, and a few years ago, bowing to fan demands, Scott's company helped produce a 6-episode reboot released in 2003. Scott's character, Henry Pollard, is a downtrodden actor who's had a promising career until an appearance in a successful beer commercial torpedoed his credibility. He has since resigned himself to tending bar and a pink bow tie. In the show's best-running gag, strangers constantly accost him with the ad's bro-y catchphrase, "Are we having fun yet?" Scott's Henry is acerbic but attentive on the job, like Sam Malone from Cheers, with a nihilistic streak. He has a flinty self-critical edge informed by Scott's own years of stymied ambition. He told me, "I just realized that you could pour all of my own insecurities into the character. Read a sunny on-screen personality and a card-carrying movie star might have been less persuasive in the role." Michael Schur, the park's co-creator, was among the few people who actually saw Party Down when it first aired, and he thought Scott's type would make a good love interest for Leslie Knope. Ben Wyatt appeared on a few episodes of the second season and became a core character in the third. In a workplace of exaggerated oddballs, Ben served as the audience's avatar, quietly tolerating his shambolic surroundings or glancing pleadingly at the camera like Jim in The Office. Poehler told me of Scott's fruitfully withholding presence as an actor. He's not an open-faced sandwich. His chemistry with Poehler, as the base to Leslie's kooky acid, made him a heartthrob among a certain breed of type A viewer. BuzzFeed published lists swooning over the character, including 22 reasons why Ben Wyatt from Parks and Rec is actually your soulmate. Scott said that his comedy era helped shape the way he thinks about acting overall. He recalled that during a scene in Party Down, in which Henry flirts with a fellow caterer, played by Lizzie Kaplan, the episode's director, Fred Savage, told him that he was trying too hard. He took me aside and was like, "Listen, you're the star of the show. You're the guy that the audience is going to go through this story with. You can just sit there and listen to this woman. You don't have to do a bunch of stuff or the audience is going to get fried." Scott felt awakened to the comedic power of understatement. On Severance, many of his best scenes involved Mark's innie, suit-clad with a neat Beatles haircut, sitting passively at his desk, looking somehow both quizzical and nonchalant. His uncritical acceptance of Lumen's eccentricities, the endless number sorting, the lame employee perks, including a midday music dance experience, the fact that nobody can say what the company actually does, enhances their ominous absurdity. During season one, Mark's innie peruses a sophomoric self-help book called The You You Are, and his face gradually brightens as he reads, his blunted mind blown open by dime store enlightenment. When comedians play everyman, their inner clowns often feel barely concealed. Jim Carrey's suburban insurance salesman in The Truman Show is a milquetoast Mr. Rogers type until he discovers that his life is a televised ruse, after which Carrey lets loose flashes of Ace Ventura-ish shtick. Even Stiller's meek male nurse in Meek the Parents eventually explodes like a shaken-up sprite. By contrast, as Schur put it to me, Scott is never over the top. He added of Scott's performance as an Ian Outie Mark, he had the opportunity to go big and play these two wildly distinct characters, but he stayed small. This fall, Scott took on a new podcasting gig as the co-host with Stiller of a show recapping Severance Season 1 called Plainly, the Severance Podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott. On a recent Sunday afternoon at the L.A. headquarters of the podcast company Pineapple Street in Hollywood, Scott and Stiller sat across from each other in a studio, preparing to tape the first 2 episodes. They decided the night before to fly in Erickson, who'd been out of town visiting family, so that he and Jackie Cohn, a Severance producer, could serve as special guests. Whereas both Stiller and Scott are wiry and shipshape in their appearance, Erickson was stubbly and dressed in baggy jeans and bloodstones, the standard uniform of the rumpled screenwriter. By the time he and Stiller began developing Severance, he had quit the door parts company and was doing Postmates deliveries on his scooter. The day he and Stiller pitched the show at Apple's LA office, Erickson was broke enough that he took a Postmates order on his way home. He joked to me later, "I bring the working class clout to this team. I've got street cred that these guys could only ever dream of." When recording began, Scott, leaning into a cantilevered microphone, introduced Erickson as the big brain behind everything. "They're bringing Dan's brain in a jar right now," Stiller added. "There'll be some sort of technology hooked up directly to the medulla oblongata, too, and there'll be a synthesized AI voice." Erickson said with a nervous giggle, "I'm not thrilled with the voice you guys have picked out for me, for my brain, my jar brain. I was just told that John Turturro's voice would be representing me." The podcast was a useful promotional push, partly because Severance has the dubious distinction of taking one of the longest breaks in TV history between its first and second seasons. At the end of season one, the Innies revolted against Lumen and found a way to inhabit their outies' bodies, leading Mark to discover that his wife is not dead at all, and that she has an innie at Lumen. "We ended on a cliffhanger," Stiller told me. "We didn't really expect it to be a 3-year cliffhanger." Fans had grown peevishly impatient. In response to an IndieWire article from October, in which a Severance producer said that Erickson had already had a vision mapped out for season 3, which has yet to be confirmed, one Reddit commenter wrote, "The twist is that the thing they're doing at Lumen is actually writing the script for the show." The wait for season 2 was due, in part, to external factors, such as the WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes of 2023, which shut down the Severance set mid-production. But some of the delay appears to have been self-imposed. Erickson, however big-brained, is a first-time screenwriter. Stiller, whom Scott described as the conjurer of Severance, has had a reputation in Hollywood as an obsessively exacting auteur. Under the title of executive producer, he is intricately involved in the show's script development, directs most of the episodes, and oversees editing and post-production. For the second season, the Severance team did rewrites up until the cameras rolled, and then additional rewrites and reshoots during filming, even if, according to an interview Erickson gave in Vanity Fair, it meant scrapping locations that were built or partially built. According to Matthew Baloney, who covers Hollywood for the media startup Puck and has followed the Severance delays, the drawn-out process caused the production to run significantly over budget. At a reported $20 million or more for each episode per Bloomberg, is one of the most expensive series currently in production. No small feat for a show set mostly in an office. Stiller told me that any numbers out there are totally inaccurate. Scott said that he approached the role of Mark like a student asking for more homework, and in time Stiller anointed him a valued collaborator. He's credited as an executive producer on season 2. Stiller told me, "I've come to rely on Adam a lot because we share the same taste, and ultimately it all comes down to taste." Scott would often join Stiller and Erickson in long Zoom sessions spent debating the philosophical and practical realities of the Severance world. What happened to innies when they retire? Do they know what America is? Despite audience fears about red herrings, the men are adamant that there is good reason for season 1's room full of mysterious goats. To signal Lumen's employees' transformation from outie to innie, Stiller came up with the idea of an eye flutter. Scott worked on the movement for weeks, finally landing on an uncanny approach where his pupils roll into his head while his jaw goes slack. Scott, who considers Stiller both his boss and a friend, justified the show's painstaking development process
as necessary for quality control. When something is being rewritten and reworked and reapproached and then torn down and rewritten, I think that's all part of the path for getting it to be as good as possible, he said. Erickson sounded more battle-worn. I don't think Ben would mind me saying that a part of the reason that it took so long is because Ben is a perfectionist, he told me, and added that he and Stiller sometimes disagreed on what perfect meant. He went on to emphasize that any conflict was always in good faith, but said, there were times where we'll have written 7 episodes and we'll have a conversation and Ben or somebody else will say, well, I think this detail could be better. And I'd sort of say, wait a second, we'd have to go back and rewrite every other episode. And often we did. As months are ticking by, that was a scary process to have to go through. Later, in an email to The New Yorker, Erickson amended his previous statements, writing, it would be inaccurate to say that production delays had to do with Ben Stiller's superpower of being a perfectionist. Stiller, for his part, told me that the creative process was not anything outside of the norm for a big sci-fi show. According to Stiller, season 2 involved 186 days of shooting. Severance takes place in bleak midwinter, and most of the exterior scenes were shot in the bitter cold in Canada and upstate New York. For the office scenes, the cast spent months at a time inside a windowless set at a soundstage in the Bronx, wandering through a labyrinth of blinding white lumen hallways. Furthering the sense of dislocation, the crew often shifted halls around during the day, so the actors would sometimes get lost and have to call out for help. Scott told me that he would regularly request 10 or more takes per scene, as many as they'll give me before we absolutely have to move on. But many people told me that he was also a leavening process on the set. Britt Lower, who plays Helly, Mark's co-worker and burgeoning love interest, said that there were strict standards around the tidiness of the Innie's hairstyles. Flyaway hairs drive me crazy, Stiller told me. Adam and I sort of rebelled against that, Lower said. At the end of every day, we'd get together and mess up our hair. After the podcast recording, we walked down Hollywood Boulevard, past the Walk of Fame, to where Scott's Electra Porsche was valeted, and drove to the Chateau Marmont Hotel to have dinner with Stiller. As the three of us sat down on the candlelight back patio, Stiller, the son of the late character actors Jerry Stiller and Anne Meara, said, I have been coming to this hotel my whole life. I'm actually staying in the room my parents used to stay in. See, my memory of this place is that I once played a bad guy here in an Aaron Spelling pilot called Crosstown Traffic about hot undercover cops, Scott said, adding, it obviously did not get picked up. Two of Stiller's parents' famous TV projects, Rhoda, in which Meara plays the titular character's friend Sally, and Seinfeld, in which Jerry Stiller played George's dad, were filmed at Radford Studio Center, where Scott's production office is now housed. When I'd visited Scott there, he told me that he liked to eat his lunch on the fake New York back lot left over from Seinfeld. Ben used to come here when he was a kid, he'd said, and now I'm here. Crazy. Earlier this year, following in the Stiller vein, Scott announced that he'll be making his directorial debut with Double Booked, an Airbnb-set thriller in which he'll also star. Catherine Hahn, who played Scott's wife in Step Brothers and spent years relegated to sidekick roles before starring in and producing shows including Mrs. Fletcher and Tiny Beautiful Things, told me that when she and Scott run into each other now, they exchange an unspoken cat-that-ate-the-mouse grin. Stiller and Scott both ordered bib solids, Diet Cokes, and red meat. A burger for Scott, a steak for Stiller. At some point, conversation turned to one of the first scenes of the Severance pilot, in which Mark's Audi sits weeping in his Volvo in the Lumen parking lot. They'd started filming the season in November of 2020, a few months after Scott's mother died of ALS. To help Scott access his grief, Stiller, who'd recently lost his father, talked Scott threw the scene over a walkie-talkie. Scott recalled he said, I want you to split yourself open. The heaving sobs captured the sequence were real. Stiller, who noted that he connected to Severance in part for its inherent sadness, said, "That's where I knew the show could work." Even if the creator's vision is meticulously mapped out in advance, it's always a risk when a puzzle box show gets extended. Can the sense of carefully calibrated suspense be sustained? Will the pieces all fit? So far, Severance does not seem liable to become another Lost, muddling its way through new plot lines as the mystery expands to fill new seasons. I've seen season 2, and it retains many of the first season's top pleasures, partially owing to Scott's ability to differentiate between Mark's two states of being, even as the innie and outie worlds begin to converge. Scott told me that when he first conceptualizing the character's divided consciousness, he thought, "The innie is everything I like about myself, and the outie is everything I hate about myself. Like a guy who thinks everything is bullshit and keeps everyone at arm's distance." In the new season, he worked to solidify the microphysical distinctions that define the two Marks. His innie bright and unfettered in the shoulders, his outie shuffling and effectively sanded down. As Lizzie Kaplan put it to me, Scott has a strange ability to seem like both the youngest and oldest middle-aged person in the world. He hired a vocal coach to master switching between the innie's obliging tone and the outie's aggrieved one. Scott's other workplace underdogs eventually escape their complacency. In Party Down, Henry decides that he is going to quit catering and give acting one more shot. In Parks and Recreation, Ben ends the show as a congressman and a married father of three. The Mark of season 2 has snapped out of his semi-lobotomized state, now a man, or technically still two partial men, on a mission to find his wife. He is not idling in neutral. Even his desk jockey side has action scenes. Filming one such sequence, Scott suffered a concussion on set for a take that made it into the final cut. 186 days, it's a lot, he told me. I'm there all the time, and I like being there all the time. It's all I've ever wanted, to be there all the time. Rachel Syme is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She has covered Hollywood, style, and other cultural subjects since 2012. She is the author of Syme's Letter Writer, about the joys of handwritten correspondence. On television, Black Doves offers a sentimental spin on the spy genre. The Keira Knightley and Ben Whishaw-led Netflix series eventually snares its protagonists in a traditional espionage plot, but it's most interested in their friendship. By Anko Kang. In the new mystery thriller, Black Doves, the purview of secret agents can include school plays, bedtime stories, and holiday decorations. By day, Helen Webb, Keira Knightley, is a model wife to the UK's defense secretary, Andrew Buchan, and a doting mother to their two kids. By night, she relays intelligence to her handler, Mrs. Reed, Sarah Lancashire, who sells information gathered by Black Doves, like Helen, to the highest bidder. That's when things go right. In the second episode, things go wrong. An assassin breaks into Helen's kitchen, where she and the intruder tussle in the dark, their knockdown drag-out brawl lit by the glow of a Christmas tree. Upon gaining the upper hand, Helen threatens him in the matter of a wrathful domestic goddess. "I have a cheese grater in the dishwasher," she said. "I have a peeler. I have skewers. I have a kettle." With vicious emphasis, she adds, "I have a neutral bullet." By the next morning, she has a dead body in her garden shed and is left fretting about the dried blood under her fingernails. Black Doves is a 6-part Netflix series created by Joe Barton. It's populated by opportunists and mercenaries who nevertheless forge genuine partnerships. Helen, in her dual role as politician's wife and mole, feels twice the pressure to keep up appearances. Her gift for spycraft also has its consequences in the familial sphere, as when she taps her husband's phone and is irked to find evidence of a flirtation with a pretty young assistant. The suspicious death of a Chinese ambassador and the disappearance of his hard-partying daughter gradually ensnare Helen in a traditional espionage plot, but the questions that feel most urgent are interpersonal, namely how she and her one-time trainer, Sam, Ben Winshaw, came to be friends, and what ultimately severed their bond. When Sam surprises Helen after 7 years away, she says that she thought she'd only see him again if he was hired to retire her. "You know I'd never take that job," he replies, "unless the money was really good." His cynicism, like hers, is quickly revealed to be a self-protective pose. It's probably not a coincidence that this sentimental spin on the spy genre foregrounds women and gay men, and that love, not geopolitics, is the governing force in the protagonist's lives. Sam's return to London is complicated by unfinished business with his civilian ex-boyfriend, and Helen is propelled by the murder of her own paramour, to whom she confessed her double life. The case supervisors and crime bosses are female, too, played by such veteran characters, actresses, as Lancashire, Tracy Ullman, and a nomadic Catherine Hunter. Respectable-seeming women can go unnoticed more easily than their male counterparts. Helen's ever-oblivious husband mistakes Mrs. Reed for a government functionary when she sneaks into a party he's throwing. She's so soft-spoken, in fact, that even Helen routinely underestimates her ruthlessness. And that's all we have time for today. By Inko Kang, a staff writer who has been a television critic for The New Yorker since 2022. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.